connection this hour was made in one family over the course of 40 years. Here's the story. Terry McGrath grew up on a farm in Michigan. Her grandfather was a hardworking man who farmed their land, often used pesticides like DDT until DDT was banned in 1972. McGrath remembers growing up picking her family's apples, grapes, currants, all of which were covered with a white film after her grandfather had sprayed the chemicals. In 2005, at the age of 49, McGrath noticed that when she walked, her left foot dragged and her left arm didn't swing anymore. 3 years later, she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, making her the sixth person in her family to receive that news. McGrath says she knew the harmful effects of pesticides, but growing up, she just didn't think about it. She's now one of millions of people across the globe who live with Parkinson's disease, the fastest growing neurological condition in the world. In her book, The Mirage of Health, Renee Dubose wrote, quote, "Every civilization has its own kind of pestilence and can control it only by reforming itself," end quote. It's a prescient statement, one that applies to us today as the world navigates the coronavirus pandemic. But it also, in many ways, applies to Parkinson's. The disease has different causes, and as Dr. Ray Dorsey of the University of Rochester Medical Center writes, for people diagnosed after age 50, the disease is most commonly caused by environmental factors, exposure to air pollution, insecticides, and more. Dr. Dorsey has written a new book on the disease and research surrounding it called A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. The book walks readers through the history of the disease and its causes. This hour, we talk about Dr. Dorsey's research, the book, and we'll also talk to a local woman with Parkinson's disease who we've met before. I'd like to welcome both of our guests. Strange to talk to them via phone, though. That's the way of the world for the moment, Dr. Ray Dorsey. It's great to have you. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much, Evan. Delighted to be with you.
And Yvonne Hilton is with us, who is living with Parkinson's. Our friend Yvonne, great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Evan.
Well, Ray, Yvonne, I kind of want to ask both of you just how your own sort of lives and Dr. Dorsey, perhaps your work, has been impacted by the ongoing pandemic. What's life like for you these days?
Surprisingly unchanged. For the last 7 years, I've been seeing all my patients with Parkinson's disease via the internet and seeing them largely in their homes, and that's continued. In fact, I saw someone late last week in northern Italy where the patient was locked down and couldn't see his local physician, so somehow found his way to me, and I was hopefully able to provide him help and care remotely from Rochester.
You think we're seeing, Dr. Dorsey, that telemedicine was already part of our society. Are we going to see more of it when the pandemic's over?
Hopefully. We should be seeing a ton of it right now. The key thing in addressing the pandemic in front of us right now is keeping people out of the hospitals to the extent possible. As much as possible, people should be able to get care, diagnosis, and monitoring in their home where it's safest, where the disease can least likely spread, and save lots of people lots of health complications.
Dr. Dorsey, I've talked to different doctors in different fields in Rochester, and you know everyone's in sort of a different boat. I mean, elective procedures are on hold, certain screenings are on hold. Obviously, emergency medicine continues at every level, but you know, you talk to different doctors, and some are being sort of told that eventually they could help with intake in emergency departments or perform different roles. If things really get sort of heated locally, things are going to stay roughly the same for you, or what are you hearing from your colleagues as well?
We want to care for people with Parkinson's disease outside of clinical settings. We want to bring care to people with Parkinson's disease and, quite frankly, with COVID in their homes and in their communities and try to keep them as much as possible out of healthcare facilities where the disease is much more likely to spread, where physical isolation is much more difficult. We need to protect patients, those with and without COVID. We need to protect healthcare workers. We need to protect facilities. We need to protect our supplies of PPE. We need to care for people where they're located, whether that's Parkinson's disease or COVID-19, and that's in their homes and in their communities.
And Dr. Dorsey, what about any special concerns for patients with Parkinson's if they contract COVID?
Yeah, so obviously people with Parkinson's disease tend to be older, tend to have compromised respiratory function, so we're advising individuals with Parkinson's disease, again, to stay home. If they need care, to get that care remotely, have that delivered by video, by phone, or if even necessary, by, you know, close to bringing care to them in their homes directly. So it's a concern for the Parkinson's community, and it's a concern for all of us.
Yvonne, what about you? What are your thoughts on living with Parkinson's and living in a pandemic?
Well, it's sort of there's this dichotomy going on, Evan. My life is sort of unchanged because, as I think I told you before, I kind of given up driving. So my life has gotten very much insular. I do a lot of things by the internet anyway. So getting out for a doctor's appointment was a big deal. That was my going out thing before. So I've been doing a lot of webinars and, like many other people, finding things to do to keep me occupied in the house. And that has been easier for me, I think, because I had a taste of it before. However, as a person living with Parkinson's, my PBS battery is starting to run low, which will require a hospital visit. I'm a bit anxious about that. I'm grateful for the pace with which the telemedicine has become available to us, and it allows so much of our care to come through. We still get the visual with our care providers, we don't feel isolated or forgotten.
Yvonne, when we talk about staying home to stop the spread, we all want to protect ourselves, but in many ways we're also trying to protect the people in the most vulnerable categories. I don't know how we would ever quantify or categorize certain spectrums of vulnerability, but are you satisfied? Do you think our society is taking this seriously to protect, frankly, people like you?
Well, honestly, I feel as though I'm very aware of my behavior. I have a super supportive network of friends. Of course, my beloved care provider, my husband, he is extra cautious about going out. And I think we travel in circles where people are definitely aware and are taking care, but we also are exposed to other people who are not maybe perhaps taking it as seriously as we should be. For example, I made up an emergency kit for my husband to put in the car so that he has gloves he can put on before pumping gas and canister of wipes to wipe things down. I tend to stay home when he goes out shopping, but there's always that chance that someone, that isn't taking it as seriously is the person who, happens to brush up against and infect, bring it home. So we're just living our lives as consciously and attentively as we can, and trying to be a good role model when we're taking our walks or when we are out in the community.
Well, Yvonne, I have to say, you're one of the really inspiring people we've come to know on this program, and I look forward to the day when we can see you right here at WXXI or in person elsewhere.
Ditto. I feel exactly the same way, believe me.
I think we're all feeling that way. Dr. Dorsey, you wrote this book. It's called A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. Who did you want to write this book for?
For those people who are with the disease, it's dedicated to those who bear the burden of Parkinson's disease, like Yvonne Hilton, and it's dedicated to those individuals who will help end the disease. We've confronted pandemics in the past, the 1950s, polio shut down schools, shut down swimming pools, shut down houses of worship, and a group of individuals mailed in dimes to the White House, raising millions of dollars to care for people with polio and to develop a vaccine. In the 1980s, a group of individuals confronted an unknown virus that's associated with a fatal condition in New York City, there was no federal response. And HIV activists in New York City and then in San Francisco adopted a motto of silence equals death. And they refused to be silent. They shut down New York Stock Exchange. They shut down the FDA. They shut down pharmaceutical companies until their voices were heard. And 15 years later, we had a highly effective treatments for HIV. We're seeing the same kind of community activism right now here in Rochester addressing the coronavirus pandemic. And if we continue to work together, we can continue to keep the rates of coronavirus low in Monroe County and in Western New York. And then once we address this pandemic, we should turn our attention to addressing other preventable diseases like Parkinson's disease.
Do you put the word pandemic is an especially sensitive one right now, and we're all sort of locked into the ongoing crisis. But how appropriate is that word for Parkinson's?
You know, most people think of pandemics in the setting of infectious diseases. But if you look at Parkinson's disease, it's the world's fastest growing brain disorder. It's faster growing than even Alzheimer's disease. The number of people with the disease has more than doubled in the last 25 years and will double again the coming 25 years. Today, 200 individuals in the United States will be diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, 1,000 this week, and 60,000 this year. No one's immune to the disease. The disease is debilitating. It robs people of quality of life. It robs people of the length of life. Our most effective treatments for the disease are 50 years old. These are the diseases, these neurological diseases are the leading source of disability in the world, even more than infectious diseases, more than cancer, more than heart disease. Neurological diseases are the leading source of disability in the world. Whether you call it a pandemic or not is largely irrelevant. What we need to do is act.
So let's talk about what we know and what we're learning. Things like dopamine. What's the role of dopamine?
So Parkinson's disease is due to a loss of nerve cells that produce a chemical called dopamine. The most effective treatment, medical treatment for Parkinson's disease is levodopa, which is a precursor to dopamine and largely replaces what's lost in the condition. But it doesn't address the underlying disease itself, and it has its own complications.
And when it comes to understanding environmental versus other factors, what is the spectrum of, you know, if there's X amount of cases, what percentage of X is environmental and could have been prevented?
So only about 15% of cases tend to run in families, and about 10 to 15% of people with Parkinson's disease have an identifiable genetic risk factor. So the vast majority of individuals with Parkinson's disease is largely dictated by environmental factors. And as you mentioned at the outset, evidence has linked certain pesticides, industrial chemicals like trichloroethylene, air pollution, and heavy metals to the disease. And these pesticides and these industrial chemicals are found both in the city of Rochester and the surrounding rural area.
Well, I mean, in some ways, your book will feel, for those of us who read Silent Spring, like that. You know, for those of us who grew up reading about DDT, it's, you know, that's going back many decades now. But then they're going to read your book, Dr. Dorsey, and say, are we moving fast enough to ending the next DDTs or the other factors that are leading to preventable disease?
So Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring in 1962. She wrote, "The farmers spoke of much illness among their families. In the town, the doctors had become more and more puzzled by new kinds of sickness appearing among their patients." And it's an untold and undertold story is how much Parkinson's disease is affecting our rural communities and the farmers in those communities. Farmers are at 50 to 200% increased risk of developing the disease. We know what some of those factors are, including certain pesticides and contaminated groundwater. We must act to prevent future people from developing the disease in the first place.
But what does that action look like? I mean, as you talked about with the HIV crisis, there was a lot of activism when it didn't seem that the government was doing much of anything at all for a while. What does the activism and the action look like now?
So we need to ban a pesticide called paraquat. Paraquat is considered the most toxic herbicide ever created. It kills the weeds that Roundup doesn't. 32 countries, including China, have banned the pesticide, but the United States has not. Use of the pesticide, including in Western New York, has doubled over the last decade. We need to end and ban paraquat. That's one thing that we can do. We can also ban a chemical called trichloroethylene, contaminating hundreds of sites. Or dozens of sites in Rochester, hundreds and thousands of sites throughout the country. We know what some of these environmental risk factors are. We know where they're located. We have not yet drawn the collective will to end and ban some of these chemicals.
But as you write, Dr. Dorsey, countries that have experienced the least industrialization have the lowest rates of Parkinson's disease. Countries with the highest rates of industrialization have the highest rates of Parkinson's disease, essentially. I mean, it's a pretty well a straight line. And is there a way for an industrialized society to be in the top tier of industrialized countries, but in the bottom tier of countries with Parkinson's disease rates?
Yeah, so one of the few areas of the world where Parkinson's disease rates appear to be decreasing is in the Netherlands. They were among the first to ban certain pesticides linked to Parkinson's disease, like DDT. Levels of the pesticide, which are found in our fatty tissue, were dropped by about 75% between the 1960s and 1980s. Air pollution in the Netherlands has decreased significantly by about over 50% over the last 20 years, and air levels of this chemical called trichloroethylene, or TCE, were among the lowest in all of Europe and the Netherlands. So there are small examples of where countries have taken action, and we can see at least signals of potential benefits in terms of decreasing the rates of Parkinson's disease.
You also write that we should accelerate the cleanup of contaminated sites. How quickly are we moving, and has that changed at all? I don't want to make this overly political, but I think it's fair to ask if things have changed in the last 3 to 4 years.
So half of Superfund sites in the United States are contaminated with this chemical called trichloroethylene. In addition to over 1,000 contaminated Superfund sites, there are hundreds and dozens in Rochester that are contaminated with it. This chemical contaminates up to 30% of groundwater in the United States and evaporates from the groundwater and soil, enters people's homes, schools, and workplaces undetected.
And I guess I'm then saying, so then what here? I mean, what's the progress look like? I mean, how fast is progress happening in your mind, and what could change?
Not nearly fast enough, because we're exposing to hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals, probably in Monroe County, to this chemical and increasing their risk for Parkinson's disease and cancer.
You write that we can. Go ahead, Yvonne, please.
May I, Dr. Dorsey? First, I'd like to say congratulations on your book. It was a marvelous read, and that it was very accessible. And frankly, I'm offended that we have not made more progress than we have as a society with Parkinson's disease specifically. You lay out a fantastic roadmap for what needs to be done. And what offends me is that so many of these steps should have been done already. And instead, the current administration is rolling back the any progress that we might have been making. It's offensive to me that we're putting people's lives behind corporate profits and lobbyist concerns and so on. It's egregious.
Thank you, Yvonne. Great to hear your voice, and thank you for all your work.
So, as
two years as well.
And to Yvonne's point, the book is meant to be accessible. I mean, though I will ask you, Dr. Dorsey, what your colleagues have made of it so far, and what they make of some of the calls for action, the urgency that you're feeling.
I don't think they quite appreciate it as much as people affected by the disease. Yvonne Hilton and her husband have a much greater feel for what Parkinson's disease affects people on a day-to-day basis. They live with it every day, every moment. I've never had the disease. I've never had my hand shake involuntarily. I've never had my voice softened. I've never been at higher risk for falling because of Parkinson's disease. The people who feel this most acutely are those with the disease and their friends and families. Those are the voices that we need to hear from. There's a million Americans in the United States with Parkinson's disease. If they make their voices heard, if they march on Washington, if they march on the EPA after the pandemic ends and say we need to ban these chemicals because we don't want our friends, our colleagues, our sons and daughters to develop Parkinson's disease, then we'll have action.
Dr. Dorsey, who's standing in the way of that? And I ask that because I'm curious. I think our listeners will be curious to know if the people who are standing in the way of these reforms are more ignorant about it or sort of look more like cartoon villains.
I think it's more ignorance and inertia. They're certainly cartoon villains, and our book wasn't aimed at identifying who those villains are. They were aimed at putting the case forward. And Rochester can and should be the community that prevents and ends Parkinson's disease. 150 years ago, this community helped abolish slavery. 100 years ago, this community helped secure the rights of women to vote. After this coronavirus pandemic passes, we can be the community to prevent and end Parkinson's disease. We have people like Yvonne Hilton, like Dan Cannell, and like Nancy Nealon, who are great voices and committed individuals for Parkinson's disease. We have rural and urban communities that are at risk for Parkinson's disease. We have a research community that's developed and identified 4 FDA-approved drugs for Parkinson's disease that have come out of Rochester, and we can foster the creativity and will to prevent and end this debilitating disease.
Talking to Dr. Ray Dorsey, whose new book is called A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. You write that we can increase NIH funding for Parkinson's disease, and this is a big opportunity for big pharma. Tell me about that.
So at the same time, the number of Americans with Parkinson's disease has increased 35%. NIH funding adjusted for inflation for the disease has actually decreased. So the number of Americans with the disease has increased 35%, and NIH funding for the disease adjusted for inflation has decreased. Parkinson's disease is also the fastest growing brain disorder, affects a million Americans, and the most effective treatment for it's 50 years old. I mean, think about that. The most effective treatment for this disease, which affects a million Americans, is 50 years old. There are few conditions for which that's the case. We clearly need new and better treatments, but more fundamentally, we need to figure out how to prevent people from ever developing the disease. It's great to be cured of polio. It's better to never develop polio in the first place.
What is the reason that we haven't seen in 5 decades a new medication, a new treatment?
Uncertain, but we need better measures of the disease. We currently assess the disease by having patients like Yvonne tap her thumb and index finger big and fast 10 times and having someone like me rate that on a scale that goes from 0 to 4, 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. We carry around supercomputers in our pockets wherever we go. We can use those supercomputers to get objective measurements of the disease both in the clinic, and the 99.9% of the time people like Yvonne are not in the clinic. So we can get objective, sensitive measures of the disease so we can tell in a shorter period of time whether a new drug is likely to work or not.
Well, let's talk to both Dr. Dorsey and Yvonne about what we can do at home, which you write about. And Dr. Dorsey, I'll start with you. Use a water filter. I mean, simple enough, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So as I mentioned, 40 million Americans get their water from private wells, and private wells aren't subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act and are therefore not frequently tested and are frequently contaminated with pesticides and other chemicals. Water filters can help decrease the amount of exposure to some of these chemicals and some of these pesticides. So since writing the book, we've adopted water filters at our home, and we encourage other people to do the same.
Eat like the Greeks, you say.
So it turns out that a Mediterranean diet, low in in red meat and other animal products, may decrease your risk of developing Parkinson's disease by about 20%.
Okay. Minimize consumption of pesticides. Broadly speaking, yes, of course, but how do you really learn to do that?
There are some websites, EWG, which we point out in the book, and the book has lots of resources for people to decrease their risk, is one thing. Buying organic fruits and vegetables can decrease your exposure to pesticides, and then washing your fruit with soap and water, which I have begun doing since writing the book.
Okay. Sweat more. Exercise more. This is big for everybody, but especially in this case. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Yvonne knows this. She's a big exerciser, so exercise helps people with Parkinson's disease. It can be yoga, it can be Tai Chi, it can be boxing. It can be cycling. In addition, vigorous exercise in your 40s and 50s, 3.5 to 4 hours a week of running and swimming can decrease your risk of developing Parkinson's disease a decade later by about 20%.
Okay, and when it comes to avoiding activities, you urge to avoid activities with a high risk of head trauma. Again, that one seems obviously nobody wants head trauma, but be a little bit more specific.
Head trauma is a common traumatic brain injury can increase your risk of Parkinson's disease by about 30%, depending on the severity of the traumatic brain injury. So if you're engaged in sports or other activities that put you at high risk for head trauma, you should wear a helmet, such as bicycling. We should also think more broadly societally about our affection for sports that have significant head trauma inherent to them.
Does that mean we need to give up our football addiction?
you know, I think we need to think about either modifying the game substantially. You know, flag football is a terrific sport, and or modify the game and substantially decrease our risk for head trauma. Not only does head trauma increase your risk of Parkinson's disease, it increases your risk of Lou Gehrig's disease, it increases your risk of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. In the book, we highlight that 112 NFL football players were, after they died, had their brains examined, and 111 out of 112 had chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and two-thirds of those individuals had Parkinsonian features during their life prior to death. We need to be much more vigilant about this issue.
Yvonne, when it comes to the way you're living your life to deal with this, Dr. Dorsey mentioned exercise. Tell me a little bit about that, your daily activity, and how much it matters to you.
Oh, it matters tremendously. I engage in Rock City Boxing, a program for people with Parkinson's. It's non-contact, so we're not getting any head injuries from it, but I do that three times a week, and I continue my yoga. With the way that we've been living our lives lately, my husband and I have been fitting in walks more as well. So the important part is getting the heart rate up and, you know, keeping it up for a sustained amount of time. But it's very, very important, and it's necessary to feel good enough to do other things as well. If I could just get one more point in here.
Sure.
This issue, and I really appreciate, again, Dr. Dorsey's book, because it's really inspired me to do something more. And I would like to be the first person to get on the bus to go to Washington. This issue should really matter to the general public, because people with Parkinson's, they're diagnosed at a certain age. But isn't it true, Dr. Dorsey, that the disease probably began the part of the brain that's affected was started deteriorating years before that. So it's really it is truly a man-made epidemic, because we haven't banned these chemicals yet, and because we don't have enough people engaged in research, we can't tell if it's environmental or genetic specifically, and we're just it's a sort of a time bomb. See, people could be susceptible to Parkinson's, or perhaps even in the early stages of it, and there are things we could be doing about it that could have prevented it. So I'm just very I really appreciate this call to action.
Dr. Dorsey, you want to add to that?
Yes, so the disease, as Yvonne was indicating, begins years before the tremor and slowness become present. So loss of smell and constipation are early symptoms of the disease, as is depression and anxiety. The disease unfolds over decades, so that if we change our behavior now, we could perhaps change the course of the disease and prevent ourselves from ever developing it. The same is true with smoking and lung cancer. You don't smoke a cigarette and then develop lung cancer the next day. It takes decades, usually 25 years or more, for lung cancer to develop after smoking. In addition, we know from smoking that people, when they stop smoking, their risk of lung cancer decreases. It would be great to think that our risk of Parkinson's disease could also decrease if we change our behaviors today around pesticides, industrial chemicals, and some of these environmental risk factors tied to the disease.
All right, real briefly here, working in a couple quick audience questions before the hour is over. Kristen in Fairport had a question about washing fruit. She'd called in off air. I think she says the CDC says don't use soap to do it. I don't know the best way to wash fruit. Dr. Dorsey?
You know, I don't know what the CDC guidance is, but I'll tell you what I do. I get the soapy, my wife buys it from Trader Joe's, a soapy solution that you can just pour into a big bowl of water, and then put your fruits in it. Some of these pesticides dissolve in fat and not in water, and so you want to wash those away, because those fat-soluble pesticides...
Sounds like
ones,
a virus.
Those fat-soluble pesticides are those the ones that make their way into the brain, which is fatty.
Yeah, boy, have we all learned about washing and hand washing and what breaks down the things that get onto our hands. It's really remarkable. Another listener said that we should point out that tremors aren't always involved with Parkinson's because that's something that comes up a lot. Go ahead, Dr. Dorsey.
So, yeah, one-third of people with Parkinson's do not have a tremor. So there are other symptoms of Parkinson's disease, slowness of movement, shuffling gait, anxiety, depression, troubles thinking, hallucinations that are all important in the disease.
In about 30 seconds, a listener wants to know if you raise kids who have played contact sports like football, do you need to be looking for signs throughout their lives of Parkinson's?
So there are other diseases that are more linked to contact sports and football, like ALS. It's likely these things play out over decades, so it's not like your kid plays peewee football and is going to develop Parkinson's anytime soon, and they play in peewee football, they're likely unlikely to develop Parkinson's. Only a small portion of football players do, but we should be vigilant and decrease the proportion that develop Parkinson's disease.
All right, and where do you want people to get the book, Dr. Dorsey?
They can get on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. They can visit our website, endingpd.org. Your first four listeners, if they put in a promo code WXXI, we'd be delighted to send them a free signed copy. They just click on Get a Free Copy on our website, endingpd.org.
Endingpd.org, and get on there now and use the promo code WXXI. He's going to send you a free signed book. Awesome stuff. A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease is the book. Made for everybody. And Yvonne, always great to hear your voice. Again, I can't wait to see you in person and to give you a big hug. But I'm really glad to hear you're doing well, and I look forward to the next conversation.
Thank you.
Yvonne Hilton, one of our favorite people. And Dr. Dorsey, congratulations on this important book. It's A Prescription for Action, Ending Parkinson's Disease. Thanks for your patience and hanging in there, and we really appreciate the conversation today.
Thank you for having us.
Our thanks to intern Emma Ray Stein, producer Megan Mack, engineer Rob Braden, the music from Barsook Records and Ra Ra Riot. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you're having a good afternoon, as good as it can be, wherever you are. And we're right back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.